Hello and welcome to the Covert Nerd Podcast. Thank you for listening. I appreciate each and every listener. It means a lot to me that you take the time out of your day to hear what I have to say. So without further ado, let's dive right into the episode and nerd it up.
Well, today, guys, we have a great new episode. We're talking to Randy from the Grolix podcast. With this episode, we're talking about Super NES and speaking about dipping your toes into other things. You had messaged me after the 80s arcade episode with Jeff, which check out the previous episode on that. I'll have that in the show notes. And I thought it was a good topic to tackle. And let's get started on the Super NES. I mentioned when we were chatting before that I didn't own this one, but my brother did. And we had at the time, I don't know if you remember this, or maybe your town had it when you were a kid, but you could go rent the consoles from the video store. And for $5, $10, I don't remember what it was, but you could rent it overnight just like videos, which might have to explain to the listener. Back in the day, you had to rent videos if you wanted to watch them at home. But you could do the same thing with consoles. And I remember when this came out and my brother rented it, we were just like, wow, this is so cool. And I think it was came out in the United States in 91, August of 91. But I remember, and maybe you had this experience too, playing the NES games, Nintendo games prior. You could tell by that time the system was starting to get a little stale and the graphics just weren't quite as cool. But when this came out, you could definitely see the gap closing between the arcade consoles and the home consoles.
Yeah, from the Nintendo to the Super Nintendo, the jump was immediately noticeable. At least, you know, I mean, I'm sure parents at the time are like, it's all the same. It's the same. Yeah. Or my dad's like, it's just cartoons. but as a kid, you're like, look at all the colors. And there's so much more going on screen. Yeah.
Well, yeah, going from the, say, Atari 2600 to the NES was a big jump. But then going to the NES to the Super NES, it was definitely noticeable. And like I said, that gap, and you could tell, and as the popularity of arcades declined, I think when these 16-bit consoles came out, I think that really, really hurt the arcades, because now I can play a Super Nintendo game like Street Fighter or something like that, and it looks almost the same as the arcade, or close enough. Whereas the Nintendo was good, but the gap was still pretty big, in my opinion, graphic-wise and sound-wise.
I feel like, I mean, part of it, like, it in one respect, it ideally would have been good for the arcades, because it would push them, the developers, then to, like, really push the hardware in the arcade cabinets. But, no, I think you're right. The problem is, you know, the more the home gaming market grew, the less that means, you know, kids don't necessarily have to go to the arcades. And then, sure. I mean, yeah, they're, as we'll talk about with my list, because two of the three of mine are ports, Super Nintendo, Sega Genesis weren't quite up to arcade quality for the most part, but like you said, they were close enough. But then, you know, the next generation rolls around and there's virtually no difference between what they could do in the arcade. So by then, I mean, obviously, that's the later 90s. Arcades are well on their way out, which is still bums me out. But man,
it does.
You guys touched on it on that episode. You and Jeff did. They got expensive. Man, they got greedy. Yes,
they did. Yeah. Yeah. We were talking about the games that were 50 cents. You're like, oh my goodness. And yeah, you think about, well, I can buy a system for, say, like the Super Nintendo when it came out was $200, or I can go to the arcade and actually have to physically go there and dump quarters in. Or I can just stay home and play on a system that is 80 to 90% of an arcade machine, but I don't have to leave my house. So it's a convenience factor too. But as the gap, like I said, gets closer and closer, it really made a big difference. When you play the 2600 arcade version of, say, Moon Patrol, and you go play Moon Patrol at the arcade, there's a noticeable difference.
Oh, yeah.
Well, or Pac-Man or whatever.
Pac-Man, if you're talking Atari 2600 version, that was awful compared to I can't believe they passed that off. But, you know, talking about that, so I'm at that age where, like, Super Nintendo was definitely hit at the perfect time, but also I would have been a Nintendo kid, the NES, and we can kind of get into that little debate later. But But I never had the original Nintendo, but I played a ton of it. You know, I had cousins and friends. Everybody had a Nintendo.
But
I didn't, and I always wanted one. I had an Atari 2600 for years when everybody was playing Nintendo, and I'd go home, I'd play Atari 2600, be like, yeah, this is pretty cool. But then, you know, Super Nintendo come out, and I did get a Super Nintendo. So that was my first, like, current-gen system as a kid. So
well, you had
I
to be ecstatic when you got that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely. I was
definitely
a Super
Nintendo. Was it Christmas or birthday, or what was it?
Oh, you know, you think that's got to be Christmas. That's an expensive gift. And, you know, my parents weren't rolling in the money, hence the reason I had Atari 2600 while everybody's playing Nintendo. That's an expensive gift. So that definitely seems like this will be Christmas. And since your birthday comes about a month and a half later, it's probably your birthday present, too.
You combine them. Yep. I totally agree.
So I was definitely a Super Nintendo kid. And I didn't realize you didn't actually have one when I approached you about this episode. But you had mentioned Super Nintendo in that arcade episode. And I was like, I wonder if he'd like to do a similar episode about Super.
Oh, yeah. I'm all up for it. Like I said, my brother had it. And when I went to college, the college friends had it. So it wasn't like you were talking about with the NES. It wasn't hard to find somebody that had one and play it. But the games on that were just astounding. And they made games on it. I did some research in Japan. They were still making games and releasing them in the year 2000. So we're talking almost a 10-year time range that they were making games for this.
Japan also, and I don't have a whole lot of details, you know, the Super Famicom, which is what they called their, you know, was Super Nintendo over there. They were way ahead of the curve because they had some super cool, basically online gaming features, which kind of blows my mind on Super Nintendo. It's amazing.
They had attachments galore on that thing. Well, even thinking of attachments, when they were contemplating what they were going to do, I found out whether they were going to just make an attachment for the NES or a whole separate system. They did think about using the port on the underside of the NES, had a port on the bottom that you could connect stuff to. And they were thinking about just making an add-on and making it 16-bit that way, which I guess in Japan, they use that port on the NES quite a bit, but they didn't really use it much here in the States. And when I read that in an article, I flipped my Nintendo over. I was like, oh, yeah, there is a port on the bottom. You have to pull up this little panel, and it's underneath there.
Super Nintendo had the port, too, and I was always had a port, too, and I was always like, what's that for? What are they going to use that for? I want to know what that's for. And they never used it. I was
so
disappointed.
Not in the States, no. But Japan, they used it for all sorts of things, yeah. Well, and it was at that time, like, and we'll get into it later, but they had the console wars between Sega and Nintendo. And like I said, Nintendo was starting to look a little stale on the 8-bit section, and the Sega Genesis came out and they started getting on top, and then Nintendo released their systems, and it was just a lot of competition, but I think we saw some good games because of it.
Oh, for sure. It's probably because I'm a kid. When you're a kid, time seems like it takes forever. So I don't think that console generation was really as long as it felt to me, especially considering we just came out of one. Oh, what was it? The Xbox 360, and that like had an extremely long lifespan compared to a lot of others. But the amount of games and classic, and of course they're old, but I mean like classic as in like well-remembered kind of timeless games that came out during the Super Nintendo Sega Genesis period. There were just so many games were pumped out.
Oh, yeah. They were just cranking those things out right and left because they were trying to kind of one-up each other. Mm-hmm. So, well, speaking of games, do you want to segue into a pick?
Let's do it.
Let's go ahead and roll in, and let's go ahead and go with my first pick because you picked it as well. So
awesome.
It is Super Mario World, and that was a game that came out in 1990. I'm sorry, I misspoke earlier. The Nintendo was released in 1990, but the Super Nintendo, or excuse me, the Mario World was released in 1990 as well. So I got that wrong, I think. But yeah, it was a game that came with the system, and it was obviously a sequel to Super Mario Brothers 3 from the NES, but sold 20 million cartridges, which is astounding. And even today's, I don't know what the stats are on today's games, but I'd be curious to know how that stacks up compared to some current games on sales-wise. But I know a lot of things are online now, too.
Now, do you know if that includes, do they include the game sold as the pack-in game with the Super Nintendo? Is that included in that figure? Do you know?
I would assume so, because okay. I remember reading on about the Wii with Wii Sports. Wii Sports sold 30 million, but they also count the fact that it's included with the system as well. So in my opinion, some of those numbers maybe are a little skewed, but still the fact that it's still huge. And I think Nintendo had this too, where you could buy this system, the basic system, without a game. Mm-hmm. And I think the Super Nintendo had that same option, so they could sell it for just a little bit cheaper by not having the game with it. But yeah, the game was just amazing in graphics. And it was made by Shigeru Miyamoto, which, if you'll remember, he's the one that made the original Mario Brothers. He made Zelda. So he's kind of the main guy at Nintendo. But Miyamoto thought that when they were trying to release the game, they were competing, talking about the console wars. They were worried about Sonic over at Sega. And he thought that the game was a little incomplete because they had to rush it to try to get it out faster, because Nintendo was trying to play catch up to the Sega Genesis and get this game out. So he thought it was a little bit rushed and might have done a little bit better. But considering the end result that we got, that kind of looks fantastic.
That blows my mind, because that you're right. This is on my list too, and that's one of the main reasons, is because the game's huge. Like, I mean, I realize we're stepping up from, you know, the original Nintendo, so it's a new system, a more advanced system. But Super Mario Brothers 3 always seems super impressive to me that they pulled that off. Like, if you look at Mario Brothers, the first one, Super Mario Brothers, the first one, and then look at Super Mario Brothers 3, it's light and day, the improvements they made. They have the overworld map thing, and, you know, it's just so much more, there's so much more game. It's much more larger and more involved. And so I was always impressed with that. And then Super Mario World basically takes Super Mario Brothers 3 and turns everything up to 11.
Oh,
it's,
yeah.
It just, like, outdoes it in all the same ways, but just better. And there's so many different weird little mechanics. And then just thinking about the weird little secrets, putting this list together, I was just thinking about, like, you know, a lot of levels had, not all levels, but several levels had multiple ways you could beat it. And then if you beat it a certain way, there'd be this little secret path that would go off, and you could go into a door, and then there's a whole another set of levels in there. And I don't know, it just always struck me as super impressive, Super Mario World.
Yeah. Yeah, and they really introduced a lot of different elements that graphically and sound-wise they just couldn't do on the NES. But kind of to back up, they really did push the NES system to the max, like you said, towards the end. But this new system, wow, the colors, you can actually see what Mario looks like a little bit. He's bigger. You could go behind the scene or behind the backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And just like you said, all the different levels, they had 96 different levels on this game. So it's just impressive.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, you're right. The colors, the graphics, and, you know, okay, so it's obviously it's pixel art, and, you know, it's... There are elements of the game, how it ran on its on the original system, that don't necessarily hold up. There were some, like, it would get slowed down. There's a couple levels I remember, if there were a bunch of enemies on screen, it'd start struggling a little bit to keep up. But, like, you look at it now still, and it still holds up. It looks good. It looks like Super Mario World. Whereas, even Super Mario Brothers 3, it still looks a little dated. But yeah. Super Mario World, it looks like for what they wanted to do, they accomplished it and didn't really have limitations. I'm sure they did. But like you said, you could see what Mario looks like. When that was always a point of contention in our house, when you're riding Yoshi and you have him eat things, you see Mario cock back and punch Yoshi in the back of the head. Like, there's just these details you can actually see.
Yeah, I like how they put that in there.
yeah.
Which is kind of funny that Shigeru thought it was a little complete. It makes you wonder, is like, well, if they would have given him, say, another 6 months, I wonder what would even more amazing.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
Of course, if you're a developer or creator of any type, there's nothing's ever really done, but it's done enough.
That's a good point. Especially, yes. Yeah, that you're right. With most art, most game, most product, most creative products for sure. But game design, I've heard that especially, it's like nothing, no game is ever done. It's just done enough.
Yes, it has to get out. And one good thing feature that they had on this game, and it was early, that Mario players have been wanting, is to be able to save the game. Because if you remember on Mario 3, well, all the other iterations, you had to kind of start where you left. You had to kind of replay everything again almost. But with this one, you can actually save where you were at. The Legend of Zelda on the Nintendo was one of the first ones to do that, that had the battery. But this one you actually could play, which I did some research and they said, yes, that made, and I remember it's like, oh, this is a lot nicer. I don't have to go back and redo old levels. I can just start where I stopped at and I can just keep going, which was really frustrating for a lot of gamers. And so you got some of the more casual gamers to play this game because of that, because you didn't have to redo some of the levels.
And that kind of, since you mentioned it, this isn't something I had thought about, but that kind of is one of the first instances that I see of something I see in a lot of modern games, the whole like appealing to the completionist, where on your save file, the menu screen, when you pull up your save, it would say how many levels you've completed. Mm-hmm. And then you could complete 90. Well, you said there's like 96
levels.
It would
yeah.
go up to whatever. And then if you also did the Star World stuff, it put the little star
yes.
there. So it's like you'd see that and be like, oh, I think I completed it all. It's kind of early. It's not quite trophies, but, you know, just little things like that little star there since you did the Star
sure.
World. It's like, oh,
sure.
interesting. It's kind of a mechanic I see in modern games.
Yeah, the completionist. And I remember talking about this on the previous episode of the Jeff on the 80s arcade. Back in the 80s at the arcades, it was about scores.
Mm-hmm.
But later on in the 90s and on, it was about level completion. So like you said, getting that star, getting that trophy, getting those levels. It wasn't really about the score anymore.
And finding all the secrets. And oh yeah.
Yes. Yeah, finding all the secrets, which is, okay, there's another change. In the first Super Mario Brothers, it was about the score.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time you get here, it's not really about the score. It's about the levels, finding the secrets, and it's much more, would you say, maybe immersive?
Oh yeah, for sure. And I think the inclusion of, and I'm not sure where they pulled it from, I know it was in other games before Super Mario 3, and it seems like kind of a Zelda thing, but just the inclusion of an overworld map or
yes.
a hub world, I think helped Mario in general, like the Mario Brother platformers in general, it feel more immersive. It feels, instead of just like world 1-1 and okay, I'm in, then I gotta run and do this platforming, it feels like you're in a world traveling around. It's a little bit of RPG element to it.
Yeah, which I agree makes it more immersive, and you have a start to get a little bit of depth because the graphics allow you to look at some of the what's behind you, or you can back up, or almost looks like you can back up, which I think adds a little bit more of the real world capabilities to it, which is indicative of the system. But just a fun game that you can just, again, the gameplay is easy. You can grab a controller and you can just start playing. And that's key to any game. And speaking of the controller, that controller is always, when I was researching it, is always in the top five of best controllers that have been ever been made. And that's, so that kind of backs up to the console itself. But
I mean, Nintendo, I get it. I get why they do it. But ever since, they've just kept messing with the controllers. Ever since Super Nintendo, they pioneered what the modern controller is. If you look at an Xbox or a PlayStation controller, that is a Super Nintendo controller with two extra buttons and joysticks.
Yes.
They pioneered the four front buttons there, the D-pad, shoulder buttons. Like,
yep.
They nailed it with Super Nintendo, and then they got all... I didn't have... Okay, so I was a Super Nintendo kid, but I was not a Nintendo 64 kid. Then they got all wonky with the weird three-pronged Nintendo 64 controller, where most of the time it wanted you to hold the middle prong, and that's uncomfortable. And then,
yes.
you know, then they're like, we don't need controllers. Like, they just went crazy with it. But, yeah.
I know. They're trying to fix something that's not broken.
Yeah. But, yeah, Super Nintendo, like, they nailed it with that controller, and most modern controllers are just an evolution of that. So
one thing that they did was on the Japanese version of the Super Famicom is they had the four buttons were just different colors, but they found out that you're not looking at your buttons when you're playing. It needs to be tactile. And so they made the two top buttons that have an indention, and then the two on the four buttons, the two top ones have indentions, and the two on the bottom are raised so that you could tell just by your thumb which one you were pushing.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Which is a slight modification that they made from Japan to the United States, mm-hmm. which I thought was really intuitive. Again, it's like you already perfected the controller. You've almost could have just moved that over to the Nintendo 64 other than putting the 360, you know, joystick on there, I guess. But mm-hmm. yeah, that I agree. The Nintendo 64 controller is good, but boy, I don't know. Yeah, it's not very comfortable in the hand.
Not to totally sidetrack, but yeah, the thing I didn't get, and of course, if I own the system, I'm sure I would have got used to it. But the thing I didn't get especially was the joystick. Most games use the joystick for movement. So why wouldn't they put the joystick where it's on the left side where the D-pad is, yeah. where it's comfortable? Like a controller is designed that way so your hands and wrists sit at a certain angle. Instead, they put the main movement controller in the middle so your one wrist is cricked to the side. It always drove me nuts. Yeah. I'm like, what is this?
When my brother did the same thing, he rented the Nintendo 64. That's the first thing I said. I said, why didn't they put, like you said, put the other one over to the left and put the four directional controller where the other one was at. Mm-hmm. You could just flip it and would have been fine. Mm-hmm. But oh well. But yeah, the Super Nintendo controller is amazing. It's just, it's perfection because you saw a lot on the PC market that they were making USB controllers that looked just like it. Mm-hmm. Well, that's all I have on Super Mario World. What's your next one that you got, Randy?
All right. So, yeah, Super Mario World was the only native to the Super Nintendo system game I had. The other two were ports. And I will go ahead and start with, I guess, the most well-known of the two. And this might be my favorite game of all time for Super Nintendo. Or just in general. Mortal Kombat 2. So, obviously, everybody knows Mortal Kombat. It's still around. But the Super Nintendo port of Mortal Kombat 2, which was a very successful arcade game, Mortal Kombat and Mortal Kombat 2 in the arcades, they were smash hits. And then they were hits on, controversial hits, mind you, but hits on the consoles. So the arcade was released in June of 1993. It hit Super Nintendo in September of 93.
That is a fast turnaround.
That's super fast. And I have a feeling that really Mortal Kombat in the arcade did well. Mortal Kombat on home consoles did better. So I'm pretty sure they, you know, developed the or scheduled the development cycle of the second one to really cater to both, you know. Of course they're going to do the arcade. But I have a feeling the end goal was still the home consoles at that point. So it was probably somewhat developed with that in mind.
It makes you wonder if Nintendo and I think it was Midway that made Mortal Kombat were talking right around the time the arcade was being released or maybe prior.
So one thing that was interesting that I didn't know before, so I was a fan of Mortal Kombat, the first one. I was a big fan of that for a lot of reasons. I could get into it later, but obviously, on Super Nintendo, the first Mortal Kombat was censored.
Yes.
It was also censored on Sega Genesis. However, the Genesis version had a blood code that would unlock fatalities. Now, on Super Nintendo, you could still do fatalities, but they were altered so that they weren't bloody. There wasn't, like, dismemberment. Some of them were just a little goofy. Like, for example, Kano in the original would rip the opponent's heart out of the first Mortal Kombat, mind you. And then in the Super Nintendo version, he'd just, like, punch their chest. He'd basically go through the motions, pull his hand out, and put his hand up in the air, but there was nothing there. And you're like, I don't get it.
A little confusing.
Yeah. And the blood was gone. The little bit of kind of blood sprites that were left were changed into, like, a grayish, I guess, sweat or whatever.
Yeah, I remember that. Yep.
Yeah. But regardless, I love that game because it was, you know, I love the martial arts with the kind of dark fantasy element, a little bit of horror element, but that really comes in more on Mortal Kombat 2. Now, the whole reason I'm going on about this is because for Mortal Kombat 2, Nintendo said, screw it, we're just going to go on censored. And that's because, and this is what I didn't know, is apparently Mortal Kombat on Super Nintendo didn't sell all that well. They looked at, you know, when compared to the Genesis release, they're like, that really kind of the sales kind of slumped on that comparatively. So they're like, all right, you know what? Just uncensored, go completely uncensored. It's fine. And so Mortal Kombat 2, which was smart on their behalf because it sold like gangbusters, but Mortal Kombat 2 hit Super Nintendo in the Western versions with blood intact, gory fatalities. Interestingly, though, the Japanese version of Mortal Kombat 2 for Super Famicom was censored. The blood was changed to green, and there were fatalities, but when you'd perform a fatality, the game would go black and white. And I thought that was very odd.
Yeah, it is weird. So that their home country, where Nintendo's headquartered at.
Yeah,
but I don't know the culture there. Maybe that was something they don't prefer, I guess, at that time.
Yeah, it kind of feels like, I mean, violence in their media is not... It feels like violence is not something they typically censor over there that often, and maybe I'm wrong, but apparently, I mean, it's probably some type of social or political issue at the time influenced the decision.
Did you get this game when it first came out then?
Yes, so...
Or early on?
I was a fan of Mortal Kombat. I don't remember if I actually owned the first Mortal Kombat or just... perpetually rented it. But Mortal Kombat 2, I didn't get it as soon as it came out. When did it come out? Like I said, September 93. So a couple months before Christmas time. I got it around Christmas time. But until that point, I rented that game over and over. Any bit of money I had, I put into just going down to the video store and renting this game. In fact, when I did finally get the game, I had another copy at my house because I had just rented it, even though I knew I was probably going to get it. I was like, I don't care. I'm not waiting. I'm going to play it. So, I was all about this game.
So you practically bought it with rental fees.
You know, kids, right? Lack of foresight, because all the money I put into renting it, I could have easily just bought it myself, I think.
Yeah. We did that too sometimes. You're like, why do we keep renting this thing?
Well, then I would have had to wait and save up money and...
You played it. I assume you played it in the arcade originally.
I did play it in the arcade. Ooh, something I wanted to touch on. So in the episode that you and Jeff did about 80s arcade games, he was talking about playing arcade games in the 7-Eleven in, I'm assuming, Fremont, because that's where he grew up.
Yes, it was Fremont. Yep.
That is the same 7-Eleven that I played Mortal Kombat and Mortal Kombat 2 on, and my grandma was the manager of that 7-Eleven.
Are you serious?
Yeah,
really?
My grandma was great. Since Jeff was one of the kids that would come and hang around, he probably didn't like her because I always got the impression that she was kind of a, oh, what's the word?
Authoritarian? Or...
Yes. Like, but, you know, to me, she was my grandma. So I'd go there and she'd buy me Slurpees, and I'd go play. I'd be like, can I have some quarters? And I'd go play Mortal Kombat.
That's awesome. What a that small world, man.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was listening to that episode. I'm like, oh, my God. Yep. But they had the Mortal Kombat machine. They'd have the Mortal Kombat machine and then some other game. Like, maybe it was one of the Neo Geo type games and stuff.
Yeah.
And then Mortal Kombat 2 came out, and they had the Mortal Kombat 2 machine. They only usually ever had two machines in there because it's still it's a small gas station type thing, convenience store. But the thing about Mortal Kombat, though, is I wasn't that good at it. Like, I played it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
The arcade games were so hard. They were just incredibly hard because they wanted to eat your quarters. And, like, the fatalities, it give you, like, 2 seconds, not even joking, just no time to pull off the fatality. So even if I, like, went home and looked at the magazines I picked up of, like, you know, all the move list, then I'd go to the arcade and try to do it, and I sucked.
Yeah.
So it was kind of awesome when it came out, because then I'd be like, I could actually just play this and not, one, have some kid judging me over my shoulder, and two, like, put it on very easy and just boom, boom, boom.
Or you play the kid that's not very good either.
Yeah, exactly. Or, hey, little sisters, want to come play Mortal Kombat? And they're like, why? So you can beat me again? I'm like, no, maybe you'll win.
You got a chance. I need to practice this. I didn't play a lot, but I assume the fatalities on the arcade were different combinations than on the game system, I assume.
No, it would carry over. They'd carry over.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I remember that was one of the reasons, because fighter games were so popular in the early 90s, that was one of the reasons they made the controller that they made. Because they had to accommodate all the buttons.
I mean, that totally makes sense. So the Mortal Kombat controls, and between Mortal Kombat 1 and 2, they didn't change. Now, the Super Nintendo ports of the games, the combat was better in Mortal Kombat 2. It seems like they ported it better. It was more responsive. I remember the first Mortal Kombat being a little stiff. Listener, I'm sure you know, but if you don't, the four face buttons were your high kick, low kick, high punch, low punch, and then you had the directions and block. And I'm pretty sure it wasn't until Mortal Kombat 3 that they added run. But that was it. So that was perfect on a... This gets me into the console wars a little bit. That was perfect on Super Nintendo. You had the four face buttons, and then you had the shoulder buttons for block. Sega Genesis did have a six face button controller available, but that was not its default. By default, yes, it had three face buttons, a direction pad, and like start or something.
Yes, you're right.
And I hated the Mortal Kombat games on Genesis, and it would always, because the console wars forever burn, but as kids, you know, I'd always be like, oh, Super Nintendo's better. Like, no, Sega's better. Super Nintendo sucks. The Mortal Kombat games, at least Mortal Kombat 2 for sure, was far superior on the Super Nintendo, and that's not, as I have in my notes, that's not Super Nintendo fanboy opinion. That's fact, because... I would go over to my cousin's house and play. He had Mortal Kombat 2. I'd be playing it at my house, and I'd go over and play it with him on his Sega Genesis. And first off, the three face button controller, you're missing two buttons. And they had some weird, goofy way where, and I can't remember if it was like if you hold up or down and then hit a thing, or if you had to hit like, say, A was like high punch, B was, this is an example, I don't remember the specifics, but A was high punch, B was low punch, C was, we'll say, high kick. B and C was low kick. A and B was block. Like, they had to do the weird combining of buttons, and that drove me nuts.
Yeah, yeah. That's always the tough part on those controllers. When you have games of that complexity, you had to have some way to combine those. You even saw that some on the NES where they had a three-button game and trying to do...
Oh, yeah.
Like a Double Dragon's a good example of that, trying to port that over to the Nintendo, but they ran into that on the Super Nintendo as well, trying to, they probably never thought, hey, we're going to put three buttons on the Sega Genesis. We'll never need more than three buttons.
Yep, yep. Like Atari had one and a joystick. One. What do you want?
Yeah, and we were happy. But yeah, a funny story on the Mortal Kombat game, when they came out with that on the Super Nintendo, when they came out with Mortal Kombat 2, it was the exact same configuration on the insides. And so what some people did is they owned, say, Mortal Kombat 1. They would go rent Mortal Kombat 2, take the cartridge apart, take the memory chips out and put them in their cartridge, and then take Mortal Kombat 1 memory chips and put them in the Mortal Kombat 2 case and then return it. And so the next person that rented it would be like, this isn't Mortal Kombat 2. That's how they were able to steal it.
I'd feel so cheated if I was the kid that come along and rented it next. Oh, that would irritate me so much. But
yeah, yeah, I heard that story way back, and I was like, oh my gosh, I never thought of that. I don't know if there was other games like that that you could do that with. But yeah, you just unscrew the cartridge, take out the memory chips, swap them out, and you're done.
Not to jump back on it, but I'm totally going to. The Sega Genesis thing, and also legitimately... I remember playing that port and just kind of being disappointed, because I get it. Like, different hardware had different limitations, but they had to cut corners in odd ways. And don't get me wrong, Super Nintendo absolutely had to do the same thing compared to the arcade port, because neither of them really, I mean, they were pretty close, like we were saying about arcade ports on 16-bit systems, but neither of them could really compete with, you know, graphically or even the audio quality of the arcades. But They would cut corners in weird ways, like the victory poses of characters. I'd be used to playing Super Nintendo, and then I'd go play it on Genesis, and like, they just cut some frames out. So basically their end pose would be different, and it's just be like, that's not even his, like, he just stopped halfway through his pose and he's just gonna like stall there with his head down and stuff. Like, they just weird things like that.
So little things that you noticed. Did you have a Genesis?
I did not have a Genesis.
Oh,
but
okay.
It was, again, kind of like Super Nintendo is one of those systems. My cousin had Genesis, so and I had Super Nintendo, you know. So when we visit each other's houses, we'd play one or the other. And I played a lot of Sega Genesis with him. So, you know, we always would... And he was such a stubborn dude. But he was one of the main ones that I'd be like, we'd get into our console war debates about. Even him, as stubborn as he was, he'd come over and he'd play Mortal Kombat and be like, dude, I hate to say it, but you're right. This does look way better over here on this one. I'm like, I know it does. But that was kind of Super Nintendo's strength. It had colors. Graphically, it could potentially look more impressive. Not that there's not super impressive-looking Genesis games. However, Genesis had its advantages, too. Games like Gunstar Heroes, I never played that till like, years later. I played it on emulator or something. But from what I understand, it ran just as smooth on the Sega Genesis, and that game blows my mind because Super Nintendo could never do anything that fast-paced. I don't know if you've ever played it, and no, I know this I haven't. Is off-topic, but you know, just to give the Sega fanboys some credit, Sega could that's Sonic, right? Like, it could handle incredibly fast scrolling. The processing was pretty quick, whereas Super Mario World, like we were saying,
yeah,
even that, it hits some slowdown. And it's not like it's a fast-moving game. It's just if there's a lot of stuff going on at screen.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you look at the specs on the Sega Genesis and the Nintendo, the Nintendo has the advantage except on the processor. The processor on that is a lot slower than the Sega Genesis. But everything else on the Super Nintendo, though, is much better than the Genesis.
And the music on the Super Nintendo version of Mortal Kombat was more accurate and it was better. Which the Mortal Kombat music, by the way, is awesome. I always loved it. It's weird and kind of creepy. The first one especially had kind of like the Eastern vibe to it. And the Sega Genesis music wasn't quite up to par, but there's something to say for the Yamaha synthesizer chip that was in the Sega Genesis. I do have a soft spot for its specific sound. Genesis system had its own specific sound that does appeal to me because it was, you know, the Super Nintendo sound system was more sample-based, and Sega Genesis was a synthesizer chip, so it all had a certain sound, and I am kind of a sucker for that sound, so...
So the sound, yes. So see, we gave the Genesis fanboys a little bit of credit.
Yeah, and nobody's even. People are like, we didn't ask. This dude just won't shut up about it.
Stop. Well, I'm going to move on to the next pick is The Legend of Zelda: Link to the Past, which came out in November of 91. And it is obviously, if you know Nintendo's history, it would be the third in the series. So you had the first Legend of Zelda, then you had Legend of Zelda 2, the Adventure of Link, and then this one, Link to the Past, which is a three-quarter top-down perspective. So just like the first original one on the NES, because in the middle there, Link to the Past, or excuse me, Adventure of Link, Zelda 2, they did a side-scroller, but they went back to the original and did it more from a top-down. But this game, of course, I have a soft spot for it because the original Legend of Zelda is the first game that we got on our original NES. And so, of course, I'm like, oh, this is so cool. But yeah, again, just when you play it, the graphics, the sound, they stuck to the original NES type of gameplay where you had to, you know, collect different things and power up, so to speak, find all the hearts. But some of the elements, like the alternate or parallel world, that concept that they came up with in this game is something that they still use in, I think, even the Switch version of Zelda has a dark world, so to speak, quote unquote, which is something that Shigeru came up with. So again, that Shigeru, you could almost do a whole episode just on Shigeru. That guy is the designer for Nintendo. I mean, you get rid of him and you just look at all the games that Nintendo would not have without him, but you can see his hand in this quite a bit.
Well, I mean, and if you think about it, Nintendo, yeah, okay, so they made the consoles. They could have potentially been as successful as they were without those games. But when you think of Nintendo, you don't necessarily think, you know, of the consoles. You think Mario. You think, Link and Legend of and Zelda, you like, and you think of the gameplay. That's the thing with these older games, these older Nintendo games, is Mario and stuff. Is the controls, like, they were so well designed, inventive, that that's really kind of what set them apart. And I don't know that they would be anywhere near where they are now if it weren't for that.
Well, yeah, and this game, for example, they just took the concept that they had and turned it up to 11. They just made the whole world bigger. They just made took some of the old characters and creatures from the old one and put them in this one and just gave them better graphics, better sound. I mean, it's been considered as one of the best games of all time. I mean, you look at a top 10 game list of all games ever, and you'll probably find this one on that list almost every time. I looked at several of them, and this one was always in the top 10, if not the top 5 of most people's best game of all time, which speaks well of just the longevity of it. I have a Super NES Classic, and this is on there, and I was playing it, and it's a fun game. You can just pick it up. Again, you can just pick it up and play it, and it doesn't take a whole lot of, you don't have to read anything. You can just kind of play it. Now I'm used to it because I've played it before, but it's just a beautiful game in my opinion. And it sold really well. They ported it over to Game Boy Advance. They did re-release it, I think, on the 3DS. And then, of course, the Virtual Console, they had it on that as well. So I think, again, that speaks to the longevity of the game, of people still wanting to play it.
Can I make a somewhat shocking confession? I've never really played any Zelda game.
Oh, really?
I've never played this. The only Zelda game I played was the very first NES Zelda game for a little bit. And like I said earlier, I didn't have Nintendo, so...
Yeah.
I'd go over to my cousin's house or a friend's house, and they'd want to play Zelda, and I'd be like, oh, I hated it. Because Zelda is not a two-player friendly game. It's a one-player play. Like,
yes, it is.
Mario is two-player, and even if it wasn't, you either die or you finish the level, you pass the controller. Like, Zelda was not made for two players, and so when I, not having a system that had the game itself, I'd go to people's houses, and I'd just hate it, because then that just means I'm... sitting there staring at them play Zelda. It's like, dude, come on, I want to play. Yeah. Let's play Punch Out.
But, yeah, exactly.
So by the time I got a Super Nintendo, I'd see Zelda and I'd be like, no, I don't care. I don't want it. I hate that game. And I don't
You'd already gotten kind of scarred.
Yeah, and I don't really hate it, but I was like, that's not for me. I don't want it. And so, yeah, and that is Super Nintendo was the last. No, I guess I had a Wii, but Super Nintendo was the last actual system I had that I played much. And since I got older, the new games look awesome, and I think I might be worth me going back and revisiting Legend of Zelda. But yeah, kind of surprising fact, I've hardly played any Zelda game ever.
That is. Well, hey, that's okay. Everybody likes their different games, but it was just a fun game, and they had a contest where somebody could be in the game, and so they included a kind of secret room. So we're talking about secret rooms on the Super Mario World. Mm-hmm. Well, they put a secret room in there, and when you go into it, it says, "My name is Chris Houlihan, and this is my top secret room. Keep it between us, okay?" So you could go, you had to do certain things to find that. There's 5 different ways to find that secret room. And when they ported the game over to the Game Boy Advance, they didn't have that secret room in it. But when they put it in the Virtual Console on the Wii and the Wii U, they did put it back in. So I thought it was just kind of a fun thing that Nintendo did. I don't know if they do contests like that nowadays or not, where you can be in a game system. But mm-hmm. when you were a kid back in the early 90s, I get to be in a video game? You know, that's awesome.
That is super cool. And I'm glad they actually did it, because different game companies would do that once in a while. They'd run some special. But most of the time, anytime I'd hear about that stuff now, it's like, oh, this company said, whatever, if they won, they'd put the winner in the game. And then it's like, but it didn't actually pan out and blah, blah, blah. So I'm glad Nintendo ran this contest and actually went through with it and did it. So, yeah.
They did were you a subscriber to Nintendo Power Magazine back in the day?
No, but I would buy it. I would buy it fairly often.
Well, they had an issue where you could make your own, they had a make your own video game contest, and one of the winners was the guy. He made a game called Lock Arm, so LOCKARM. You can Google it and you can find it. And he had some designs that he came up with. It was really cool. So then this would have been before the Zelda game here, but they just really seemed to really glob on to that concept that the kids that were at that time would love to make their own video games. And I think they did an article about the guy that made the Lock Arm game, that he did end up getting into game design later. So I thought that was kind of cool that Nintendo really tried to encourage kids to make things like that. And like you said, they actually executed on it and put them in a game.
That, yeah, no, that's awesome. Makes me think of... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, it makes me think of, you know, Super Mario Maker. I like games like that that encourage people to be creative.
Yeah. Do you have that on the Switch? I think they had it on the Wii U, too, I think.
Yeah, the first one was on the Wii U, and the second one, which came out not long ago, is on Switch. I haven't had either. I don't really want to buy a Switch, but Super Mario Maker 2 really tempts me.
It's my son has it, and my kids play it, and they like that. That's a really cool thing. But yeah, right. That's a cool concept that they can put into games like that. I remember way back in the day in DOS games, there was a game called Wolfenstein 3D, and they actually made a Wolfenstein designer, so you can make your own levels with it. So again, it's tapping into that game making concept.
Oh yeah, I'm a sucker for that.
Yeah, they even have some Zelda. If you don't like playing Zelda, Randy, you can make a Zelda game. They have designers out there where you can make an old Zelda game, which is kind of fun. I kind of played with it, but
I try not to do it because I will lose time. But I mess around with Game Maker Studio quite a bit, and tool around with making 2D games and stuff. So yeah, it's something I enjoy doing, but I'm not a good coder. And like I said, then it takes so much time. I can't do it. I can't commit to it.
Cool. Well, that's all I have on Zelda. What's your next one, Randy?
All right. My final pick is, this is the slightly more obscure game on my list. In the US, it was released as Out of This World. Europe, it was released as Another World, and I can't remember what the Japanese title was. Something similar to the European title. But yeah, so Out of This World, which was released in November 1992 on Super Nintendo. This, again, was a port. It was not an arcade game, though. It was a port of... How did I not write that down? Hold on, let me find out, because it's kind of interesting. It's one of the weird kind of desktop consoles from back in the day. You know what I mean?
Yep. Yeah, kind of like Myst, I think, was... Is it kind of like that? I was looking at some of the screenshots.
Okay, so it's not exactly like Myst, but think maybe a little bit more platformer. Okay. So the visual style is it's 2D side view. Now it's like a side scrolling platformer, but it's not side scrolling, and that's where I think the Myst comparison is, or the Myst like connection is not inaccurate. Where you'd be on a screen, when you get to the end of the screen, then it would go cut to the next screen. Okay. And so, you know, it didn't actually scroll. It would just, what they call flip screens or whatever. But you actually ran around, walk, run, crouch, jump, swim, stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember seeing look at the screenshots here, and I remember seeing it. The graphics were actually, and the gameplay was really unique, I think, for the time.
That's kind of the main thing, why this game was amazing to me is because it's the most cinematic style game I remember playing on the Super Nintendo, and at the time it really blew my mind. Also, I found the storytelling was awesome in that it was super engaging and did really really great world building without any spoken like English or text. And I mentioned world building because so the whole premise is. You play the main character, Lester Knight Chaikin, a physicist, and while working with a particle accelerator in his lab, the lab is hit by lightning and he is zapped out of this world to another world.
Sounds like a Marvel origin story.
Yeah, basically. And he ends up on an alien planet. There's hostile creatures and also kind of a humanoid alien race. And then that's your adventure. And it's super interesting because to explain to the listener who might not have screenshots or anything pulled up, it's not like cartoony look. I mean, it is, you know, Super Nintendo, but it's not like colorful cartoony. It's very like the color palette is very deliberate. It's kind of muted. It's kind of dark, you know, lots of grays, blues, stuff like that. The animation style, think Prince of Persia. It was rotoscoped. Style animation where basically the developer, and this was one of those games that was developed by one guy, I believe a French developer, programmer, and he used a live action video of objects as well as himself, and he would basically animate polygons over top of that and then that became the base for the animation. So it's got like the movement of your characters, very cool. It's kind of, if anybody played the old school, very old Prince of Persia games, you know, you kind of know what I'm talking about. It's just got a certain movement to it. Although this game, I feel like was less stiff than Prince of Persia, which was kind of stiff by default because you'd have to stop at like ledges and stuff. And there's a little bit of that to this, but it's not as stiff, I feel like.
Yeah.
Also, this has like cutscenes. Like, and that's not completely unheard of in, what was it, I say 92, but they play out like they're much closer to like full motion video cutscenes than anything else I had played on Super Nintendo at the time. That opening scene, like I said, like it's rotoscoped animation of like this car flies up to the lab and then your character gets out and goes in, and it's very atmospheric. The music is, there's a lot of tones and atmospheric music, but there's also some original music, you know, score that's kind of subdued. And it's just got a super strong focus on just kind of the feel and the cinematic feel. And the story is very, I believe I read that the developer was inspired by stuff like, you know, Dune and other like sci-fi novels and stuff like that, and science fiction comic books.
He seems to be very intentional about everything, mm-hmm. and very, what do I want to say, very very concerned about the environment about that they're in. So like you said, about the lighting, about where things are placed, how they move, whereas you get the feel in some games that they're just kind of, it really doesn't matter. They're just kind of throwing it together, so to speak. But this one seems almost like a canvas, an art piece for the designer.
Yeah, and that's exactly, yeah. And like I said, so it's side-scrolling, but every screen is basically a new, basically every screen's like a new image, right?
Yes.
And so all the backgrounds were, you know, he arted them up, whatever. He designed all the backgrounds. And I love that idea of the single developer, which you see more now since, like I mentioned, Game Maker Studio and like Unity is, you'll see that more now in indie games. But I love the idea of this solo developer Game Maker, where this is definitely like his singular vision. And I could be wrong, but I think he also did the score. Now, in terms of a port, this is, I wish I could remember what the original system was.
Oh, so this wasn't original to the Nintendo?
No.
Oh, okay.
Well,
it might have been PC, I think. You think, maybe?
It was something odd like a, what did he like develop it on?
The Amiga?
Yeah, something weird like that, right?
Yeah.
So apparently it was originally released on PC, Amiga, Atari. That's kind of vague. I don't know what Atari.
So yeah, it was initially Mac, for the Amiga and Atari ST. Yep.
Okay, there you go. And then ported over to other systems. And I think, you know, so it's not necessarily coming from like arcade, we have to downgrade this to port. You know, in fact, the home console, like the Super Nintendo version, I don't know about the Genesis version. I didn't look too much into that. He actually is actually longer than the original version that it's ported from, because Nintendo or Interplay or whoever the developer, you know, picked it up to distribute, Interplay wanted more. They wanted the game to be longer. They wanted more gameplay. So they're like, hey, can you design some more levels to this or whatever, however it works. So yeah, the Super Nintendo port's actually longer than the original version it's based on. And I believe there's more music, or there was some music cut. I don't remember the compromise, but yeah. And this game is actually, you can find this on Steam now.
Really?
I believe at the 15th anniversary, he kind of revamped it. And then on the 20th anniversary, which wasn't that long ago. Okay, I guess it was a little while ago. But he released a remastered, a HD remastered version where it's still the same game, but he kind of up the artwork a little bit. Like, there's definitely more detail. It doesn't look vastly different, but the original art style, the colors are very flat. Like, it's not like a lot of shading. It's kind of flat artwork style. And so there's just a bit more shading and detail added to the new version. I bought it. I have it on my computer. I haven't played it yet. I will sometime.
Well, when you got this on the Super Nintendo, how did you happen to find this? Because, you know, most people are like, okay, I'm Mario's, Metroid, Mortal Kombat. You know, you have kind of your staples. But this seems more of a kind of a one-off.
Yeah, no, yeah, it is. And Well, I guess there was a sequel, but this is, yeah, it's not, it wasn't some big smash hit. This game, so I had read a totally unconnected thing. Around the time this came out, I had just moved to Fremont, like we were mentioning earlier, Fremont, yeah, in the arcade. I had just moved to Fremont, and I didn't have any friends yet, so I'd hit the library, and I was reading a lot. I'd read all the time, and I happened to read some sci-fi book called Out of This World, which is actually, in retrospect, a super cheesy title for a sci-fi book, but and I loved it. And then we were in a video store looking for, or, you know, looking for a game to rent, and I come across this, Out of This World, and it looked like a sci-fi thing, and now it has nothing to do with the book. It's totally unrelated. But I was like, oh, Out of This World, I know this. Let's rent this. And rented it and, you know, enjoyed it, thought it was great. But more importantly, and this is one of the very, like, my dad would occasionally find a game he'd like. My mom, even rarer, would find a game, a Super Nintendo game she liked. This is one of the very rare instances which my mom and my dad both seen it while I had rented it and were like, what's this game? This looks awesome. And of course, it, randomly, this is like one of the only times I got a game that wasn't just like a birthday present or something. And I could be wrong, but I believe it's just one of those like, hey, we bought you this, like out of nowhere. And it was the game. It was Out of This World. And I'm like, wow, why? They're like, just because. I'm like, you want to play this game, don't you?
You want to play it too?
So
that's
they
awesome.
Loved it. And it's, even though it's a one-player game, it's cinematic enough to where my mom or my parents, they'd like, we'd all sit down and play some Out of This World. Or, you know, I'd be at school or something, come home, and they're in my room playing Out of This World. I'm like, I want to play Super Nintendo. But yeah, so it's one of those things where it had a kind of a more vast appeal.
Multi-generational appeal to it.
Yeah, so it definitely, you know, that helped, because that, otherwise, like, I don't know that I'd have thought. I probably would have rented this once, thought it was super cool, and then re-rented Mortal Kombat or something, you know?
Yeah,
and not even
yeah.
thought about it. But because they really latched onto it, and then, yeah, it is a great game, though.
That's funny how all of a sudden, if you ask for a game, like, we don't have money for that, Randy. And then all of a sudden, well, I like this game, so miraculously, we have enough money for this game.
Look what we got. And it probably helps that I don't remember how much this cost. I don't know how much this cost at the time, but it wasn't a Mortal Kombat. It wasn't a top-tier game necessarily.
No.
So it was probably a little cheaper.
I would guess in the 30s.
Because
usually your Mortal Kombats were 49, and so you kind of had the tiers 49, 39, 29, and then
a lot of the other games I had were not top tier games, like your RoboCop 3 or 2, RoboCop 3 or Hunt for Red October, of all things. Like,
yeah.
So I tend to get, when my parents would buy me games, it'd be like they recognize the movie title and it's a cheaper game. None of those games are going on this list, though, I tell you that much.
$9.99, you know,
right?
For the, you know, adaptation of, like you said, RoboCop 3 or Robin Hood or something like that. You know, I don't know.
Oh, no, yeah. Everything. That's, we said, you know, this time period was great. There were so many classic games made, but also, like, this isn't the time period where, you know, Nintendo 8-bit, 16-bit era, especially, anything. They just license everything out. And
yes.
then slap, it's basically they'd slap an Addams Family or random things, like I can't even think of what. They just slap a skin that's a theme of this on some generic kind of sloppy 2D platformer.
Oh, yeah.
So that is the downside to that era of games, but this was not one of those. This is it's an original title, Out of This World, and kind of flew under the radar, I think, for a lot of people, but it's pretty awesome. A lot of people might be familiar with a game called Flashback, which is very similar. It's not the same developer, but it was released through Interplay, and it's got a similar style and a little bit of a similar feel, and is actually quite a bit more in depth, and I like that too, but I'm a sucker for Out of This World, so that's why that had to go on the list.
You're right. They would stick a title on just about everything. They had, you know, Wayne's World. Like, Mario is Missing, I think, was one. I mean, they tried to, because of the console wars, each one was trying to outdo the other, so they would just slap a game and sell it as fast as they could.
And companies, they realized they could make a cheap, like, if they owned a property, if movie studios had a, you know, a Demolition Man or a Wayne's World or a, you know, Fox had, you know, The Simpsons. So, of course, they got Simpsons and Itchy and Scratchy and anything else they can pull out of there. And just they would license that out to the lowest bidders.
Yeah.
And so you've got these game studios that just would exist to bid low, get the rights to this property, or bid high. I don't know how it works with licensing properties. And then just pump out some crap just to get it out there because they know it's like remake. I've had a similar conversation about a lot of the live action Disney stuff, not to say that's just pumped out there like junk, but it's the same thing of like, it's a title at least parents will recognize. They're going to buy it. We're guaranteed money.
Yep. Yeah, same thing with the games. Yep. Wayne's World was a big movie. We'll put a name on it, and even though it might not be a great game, we'll still sell 100,000 to 200,000 cartridges just because it has the Wayne's World name on it. So that's kind of a segue. How did – this is a total off topic, I guess. Well, maybe not. You had the crash, the video game crash in the mid-'80s because of the same thing, but it didn't really happen in the 90s.
For the most part, because I feel like it wasn't those game. None of those games were tentpole games. It'd be like if Marvel, if Disney. Well, bad example, but you know, because I happened to mention them a moment ago. Bad example because Disney has all the money in the world. They're never going to fail. But it'd be like if a movie studio channeled $600 million, which they do sometimes, into a movie, and they're banking on this one tentpole movie. That's their summer blockbuster, and if it tanks, the studio's going under. That was the E.T. game, along with some other stuff. It would be, and there were other systems, but I think Atari was the reigning king.
Yes.
Whereas at this point in time, most of those games, those kind of like crap license games, and in the case of E.T., from what I understand, it was crap because they wanted that rushed out. It's not necessarily the developer's fault.
They wanted out to cash in off the movie.
And so I guess it's the same thing. But the difference is like, none of those, during the 16-bit era, none of these were like tentpole games that are going to crash the entire market or sink a console.
That's true.
And there were so many other games. And
you had two systems.
Exactly. You know? Two reigning supreme systems, like, I think, kept the competition going. I feel like that's probably why we never really encountered it like that.
I just kind of thought of that when we were talking about it. It was like, well, you kind of had the same thing in the 80s, but maybe not quite the same thing. So awesome game. Well, let's move on to the last one that I've got is Super Mario All-Stars.
I'm so glad you added this.
Well, this one is a great compilation system. What it is Nintendo put their old games onto one cartridge. So you had the original Super Mario Brothers from 1985. Super Mario Brothers: The Lost Levels, which was not released in America but was in Japan from 1986, and then Super Mario 2 from 1988 and Super Mario 3 from 1989, I think is when that one came out, but all on one cartridge. But what they did is they increased the complexity of the graphics on the three games. I don't think they did it on The Lost Levels, if I remember correctly. I think Lost Levels was strictly, for real quick for the listener, The Lost Levels was basically Super Mario Brothers 2 in Japan, but they didn't release it over here because the rumor has it that they thought it was too hard and that the Americans wouldn't like it. And so they reskinned an old game and put the Mario characters onto a game system and made it Mario 2. So they decided to release these unreleased games into America on the Super Nintendo. But anyway, they revamped the music and the sound and the graphics for Mario 1, 2, and 3. And then the later iteration they came out with it, they put Super Mario World onto it as well. So you got five games for one price. I really like it just because it's got a lot of nostalgia, because on the NES, we had all the original Mario 1, 2, and 3, and just seeing how they were able to increase the graphics a little bit on all of these, it's just a fun way to play all these old games and revisit some nostalgia on it. And Mario All-Stars actually sold, let me look it up here, 10 million units. So it's second only to Super Mario World, which I thought was impressive.
It's second only to Super Mario World, so that means... And Super Mario World sold 20 million?
Yeah, and this sold 10 million.
That's incredible for Super Mario World because it's a solid double what their other highest selling game is. Okay, interesting, interesting.
Shigeru Miyamoto did this or came up with this concept after Super Mario Kart came out in 92. And he came up with, well, why don't we put all these old games on a compilation cartridge and sell it. Basically, if you think about it, really very little involved on their part other than going back and redoing some of the graphics. And they did them very much in the style of Super Mario World, you can tell. Mm-hmm. But still, the sound and one of the things they did on, I think it was Super Mario 2, when you get the mushroom and you grow big, but then you lose it and you grow small. All they did on the NES version was just basically cut the bottom third or so of their body off and just put their legs on. But on the compilation on this version, Mario All-Stars, they actually gave them, they shrunk them down and made them look more proportional. And so that was just kind of one little thing that you notice on the increased graphics or the better graphics on this one compared to the other one.
Yeah, I had Super Mario. I'm glad you added this to the list, and I was tempted, but I was like, I'll bump it off for one of the other ones since it's technically a re-release of old games. But I'm glad you added it because this was another one of my favorites because I didn't have a Nintendo. So yeah. When I seen this was coming out, I was super pumped because I loved Mario Brothers 1, 2, and 3. Oddly enough, though, I was actually a little like on the Super Nintendo, on the Super Mario Brothers, the first one, it wasn't so bad, and the second one isn't too different. I was actually a little disappointed they updated the graphics just because I was like, I want it to look like it did. I want it to look like, you know,
the original.
Yeah. That's what I like. Also, Super Mario Brothers Lost Worlds, first off, I'm kind of smart decision on there, even though Super Mario Brothers 2 is so weird and different, and it was what it was, a basically reskinned Doki Doki, Yumi Kojo Doki Doki Panic. Super smart decision on their behalf because Super Mario Brothers 2, as apparently it was released over there, The Lost Worlds, for one, it was pretty hard. But two, it's at most, it's like an expansion pack on Super Mario Brothers.
It is.
It doesn't really innovate at all. Like, it's almost exactly the same.
No.
And I want to say, like you were mentioning, they didn't necessarily update the graphics on that one. I think it's just because they pretty much just pulled the sprites from the first game.
Yeah.
And so I think it was a smart decision of Nintendo or Nintendo America or whoever came up with the idea to kind of like, let's scoot that aside and do something different for Mario 2.
I completely agree. You're exactly right. The Lost Worlds or Lost Levels, whatever you want to call it, was just, it was Super Mario Brothers, the expansion pack. There's nothing new here other than I don't know that they include any new characters or anything.
There's the I think the poison mushroom was
poison
the
mushroom.
Only
That's
thing
right.
I really
That's
remember is like, oh, great, they added a mushroom that kills you. That's what I want.
Yeah, and Super Mario 2 over here, I mean, they had a lot of cool little things. You could finally pick up something and throw it. You had the kind of the reverse worlds when you put the potion down and you go in the door and it's a reverse. I think it was a smash to do. You had the Birdo and all these other characters. And I think, was it Shy Guys were the first? Well, no. I can't remember which characters are unique to Mario 2, but
I think Shy Guys.
I think they still...
Well, I don't know if they've used them in other things, but they popped up in there, didn't they?
I think they have some characters that were in Mario 2 that they used in later iterations of the Mario. But so I think it was smart. And then you put, like you said, for somebody that didn't have a NES, and you put all these on one cartridge for $40 or $50 or whatever it was. I mean, that's a heck of a deal. How much did you play? Did you play through each one or try to play through each one?
Oh, yeah, I played. Yeah, definitely. And since I didn't like I played a bunch of the original games on Nintendo at people's houses. And, you know, I'd played through Mario Brothers and, you know, been with people and we played through Mario 3. But this actually gave me a chance to, like, sit down my own copy and play through all the games.
I want to finally get to do it.
Yeah. I don't recall if I beat Lost Levels or Lost whatever. Yeah, whatever that one was called. I don't
Lost Levels. Yep.
If I beat that one or not. Or if I was like, I don't care about this one. I beat Mario Brothers.
Yeah.
This one, this is just...
Yeah, but I was kind of the same way. I'm like, I just want to play 1, 2, and 3, and I dabbled in Lost Levels.
Mm-hmm. But, Mario 3 is, like I was saying much earlier, it's such an improvement and, like, a pretty large game. So it gave me a chance to, like, actually play through that game, check out the stuff. Warp Whistle if I want to, maybe not. And then Mario 2, I don't think I'd ever actually played through and beat on, you know, over at friends' houses. So it gave me a chance to play through and beat and, like, discover that it, spoilers, it's all a dream.
Yes. But, yeah, I know. That's kind of the ultimate. But it was a fun game. Some people really dog on Mario 2, but I thought it was actually pretty darn good.
Yeah, I thought it was cool. Like, I mean, I'm glad Mario continued, because Mario Brothers 3 is definitely an extension on Mario Brothers 1, but that is the appropriate, like, it feels like the appropriate improvement on the original as opposed to lost levels. So
yes, I agree.
So I'm glad they went back to the actual Mario platformer style, you know, run jump.
But
Mario Brothers was too, Mario Brothers 2 was cool. It was a good change.
Yeah, and they had on the Super Mario Brothers, I don't know if you remember, there was a World 0-0 where it's endless swimming that you can do. But I guess on this version, Mario All-Stars, they did not port that over to it.
Really?
Which I thought was kind of funny.
Interesting.
Even though there's rumors that they did, but I guess I did some research and they said, no, we didn't actually port that over, that 0-0 world. So
the worst just, world.
Funny little thing, that trivia.
I wonder what that... So is that something they actually threw in there as just like a Easter egg or something? Or is that like one of the weird glitches because of how
it was a secret level.
Okay.
Secret level slash glitch is kind of how they put it. I'm sure the programmers, when they were doing it, maybe just, let's throw that in there and just have them swim forever and see what happens.
Awesome.
On Mario, one thing I forgot to mention is on Mario World, there's a level where you're swimming and there's a ship in the background. That ship is the airship that you sink in Mario 3.
Yeah. I remember that. Oh, my gosh.
I kind of forgot about that when I read about it. I'm like, oh, yeah, that is true. So
I remember seeing that when I was a kid playing that, I thought that was so cool to see, like, actual. And that's another thing, like, you know, just the beef up of graphics. They can add little things where it's like, that's a straight up callback to the last game. How cool.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I was
like, that's a good idea on their developer's part. They're just they're so smart at Nintendo back then. I mean, they still are now, but just little stuff like that, that back then that was so pioneering to do something like that.
I feel like, I mean, Nintendo now, and it's not always successful. The Wii U, I think for the most part, it was kind of a failure for them, but they're still pioneering in some respects. They're obviously still experimenting with the system. But I kind of feel like they've just been coasting off these old games, these old properties, in terms of, like, not to say, like, the new Mario games aren't super well developed and designed and stuff like that. They are in the new the Zelda games. Like, Breath of the Wild looks super awesome. I've been super tempted to figure out how to play that. But, I mean, the properties themselves, though, are from the original system. So
yeah.
I think about that sometimes, like, when are they gonna, like, or Smash Brothers, it's really just Nintendo's just riding on nostalgia, and I wonder, like, how long they can do that.
That's a good question. The players seem to eat it up, though, man. I've got kids, and you see these esports guys are competing in Smash Brothers tournaments and doing all sorts of things with it. So I don't know. But you're right. It's like, when's the new stuff, or when are you going to come out with something new that might be a little different? But they have so many properties. They could go back and just mine stuff. Like Kid Icarus, that's a property they've never really resurrected from the old NES days, that they've never done a game that they probably could. Or there's something else we can do with it.
I'm kind of surprised, too, because I would think something like a flying guy with a bow and arrow, like, I don't know, think of Breath of the Wild, like something like that. You got a flying guy with a bow and arrow, put him in an interesting world, and there you go.
Yeah.
Like, I think it'd be cool, make for cool gameplay.
It would. Well, I got a couple honorable mentions I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on, but I saw this and I kind of forgot about it, the Super Scope on the Super Nintendo. It's like the bazooka.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
I do. I didn't.
Did you have it?
I didn't own it, but one of the games I mentioned earlier, Hunt for Red October, you could play it with a controller, but it was designed for the Super Scope, Super Scope 6. Why was it the Super Scope 6? I don't know. But
it was the Super Scope 6, yep.
It was designed for that. So, yeah, I never played with one, though. That's ridiculous.
It was, I know, it was just ridiculous. Like, why? I know they're trying to use the zapper from the original NES, but it's like you could have just skipped this. It's kind of one of those attachments. Like, really?
Just do another. I mean, just do another zapper. You know, yeah, everybody loved zapper. Duck Hunt. Just do another zapper. But they had to. They had to one up it. They had like, nope. NES had a pistol. Super Nintendo's got a bazooka.
Exactly. It's like, we're going to be even better. Yeah, that's exactly. So I wanted to mention that. I think
that's the 90s.
Our friends.
That's the 90s right there.
I know. Yeah, exactly. I don't think I ever used one, but I remember seeing it. I'm like, oh, this would be kind of cool. But now that I look back, I'm like, that's kind of dumb. But at the time, you know, they're just, hey.
As a kid, what's cooler than a bazooka?
Bazooka. Yeah, like you said, I had a little teeny tiny – you can see Johnny at school saying, I used my zapper on my NES, and Billy over here is like, oh, yeah? Well, I got a bazooka, you know.
Super Scope 6.
It's with dad.
You know it's awesome. Hear listen to all the alliteration. Super Scope 6.
So yeah, that was a fun one. Pilot Wings was another game that was one of the early ones that really showcased the graphics capabilities of being able to go zooming in and out and showing how things can move a lot better on the Super NES compared to the NES.
What was that? The chip that they used in Star Fox.
Oh, was the 7?
Yeah.
Something 7. I can't remember what it is.
Mode 7 chip or whatever.
That might be it, yes.
They use that in Pilot Wings as well, right?
I believe so,
it
yes.
It was like the only two games that used it.
Yes.
Okay.
And then, of course, you had the fighter game, Street Fighter and Mortal Kombat were huge. And then the one that still is played a lot today and I still love is Super Mario Kart. Now, I didn't really like it on the Super NES, but on the Nintendo 64, that really, we fell in love with that because you could play four players at once. The graphics and sound were just so much better. But the Super NES is where it started.
And yeah, and that was a great game on the Super Nintendo because it was, you know, I'll quick throw in a runner-up, like F-Zero was kind of a classic game. And my dad loved F-Zero, and F-Zero was fun. But Mario Kart was a kind of fun, goofy racer that was at a slower pace that my sisters could play. My sisters weren't interested in F-Zero, but my dad liked it. But Mario Kart, everybody play it. It's cute enough. Yeah. It was slow-paced enough that, like, but it's still a fun racer. Yeah, Mario Kart was great.
The concept, simple. Like you said, being able to just pick up a game, pick up a controller, put it in, turn it on, and play without hardly any instruction is key to game design in general.
And battle mode was brilliant.
Battle mode was
real good, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I wanted to ask you on F-Zero, since your dad liked it, does that mean you were able to get it in between Christmas and birthday?
No, oddly enough, like, he loved it, and I would rent it fairly often, but it was not one of the ones that they bought.
Oh, darn. No.
Out of This World was a one-time thing, I think. It was a rare deal where I think my mom liked that one as well, so that was part of it.
But
my mom, first off, was not a racer game fan, but also she gets motion sickness from video games, especially racing games and stuff that move like that. So Mario Kart was out and like F-Zero, so he wouldn't have been able to get her behind that purchase.
Dang. Oh, well. So, well, any other honorable mentions that you could have made the list that didn't?
I do want to throw out one more. And I knocked this off because it's not really a game, but what was it? Mario Paint.
Oh, yeah.
I loved Mario Paint. And I realize it's basically just, you know, MS Paint. But you could do little animations. It had a music section. Like I said, I'm a sucker for creativity games. Even now, like, that's, you know, I'll get into, like, a sandbox game or something. But, you know, like Minecraft or something, like creativity games, I love it. And this was, you know, I didn't have a computer back in the day, and so, you know, make up weird art or little animations, and because you could, the animations was super cool. I mean, you were very limited on how many frames you could do, but you could actually like animate sections of a picture. So I'd make a whole, like, make the background and stuff, and then make either a little character or part of a character and do little animations. And I wish I still had it, but I actually cut together like a very short, like, short film, short animated thing that I made with it, where I'd basically make a background, a little animation, and I don't know, it'd be like just a looping something second clip, and then, you know, have the Super Nintendo routed into a VCR, hit record, pause, load up the next one, do my little artworks, hit record, and I'd put together a little short, but it got recorded over at some point.
That's amazing. Actually, funny story that a lot of animators got started on Mario Paint.
Oh, I had not heard that, but I could absolutely see it. I love that.
In fact, Homestar Runner, the guy that made Strong Bad, those guys, the two brothers that made it, that's where they started with the whole concept, was on Super Nintendo.
Oh, I love Mario that. Paint. I love that.
And I've heard some other guys that got started in animation from the same thing. But yeah, too bad he recorded over it. I want it to be funny to watch now.
Oh, I know. I think I put music over it, but it wasn't like, I didn't use Mario Paint music or anything. Corn or something, some of this music from that I was listening to at the time I put over it, and even the music section, it was a little cheesy because like the sounds, you know, the little pig oink and the Yoshi like when you get on a Yoshi, just weird sounds. But the fact that you could like basically make the sheet music on there and it would play it out, like, I don't know, I just think about that, and then the stuff I end up doing, like, it's not that far off of how I actually create music, and I've done that so much as an adult. Like, it's definitely, you know, creativity games. I love it.
He has been doing podcasting for how many years now, Randy? 6 years, something like that?
It's 7 years now. Seven. Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Grolix has been going for almost six. We'll be coming up on six before too long. But yeah, in general, just over 7 years. Thanks to Facebook for reminding me that of, you know.
It does that for you.
Yep.
That's a fun podcast, Jesse. And Melanie and him have a great time talking about pop culture, comics, kind of whatever. But I know you've kind of slid over a little bit more to the movie side too, mm-hmm. which is kind of branching out. And I don't remember, as of this recording, you're still doing the lunchtime episodes, which I haven't been able to get in on lately. But mm-hmm. I know you've been doing those too. So you really like to dip your feet in different waters, I guess, so to speak.
Yeah, well, I mean, Grolix podcast itself, like you said, it's mostly, it's comic books. The last couple years, I've kind of fallen off of reading comics so often, so we'll alternate kind of between comic books and TV shows, whatever, you know, reviews of whatever we are consuming at the time. But yeah, you're right. I do. I'm a man of many interests, I guess. So we did a spinoff podcast that's ongoing, Grolix Cinematic Universe, and that's movie stuff, in which me and I have a different co-host on that one, Jasper. We do a themed double feature every episode. We'll review two movies of, for example, one of my favorites were one of the early episodes we did was, what was it? Flash. Like Flash Gordon and the Highlander, because the soundtracks are both by Queen. So I was like, sci-fi Queen.
Oh, okay.
You know, just random. And sometimes the themes aren't that clever. You know, sometimes one of them, we did an old movie called, well, we did The Birds, Alfred Hitchcock classic. And then we paired that with an old movie called The Deadly Bees. So it was The Birds and the Deadly Bees.
Birds and the Bees. Yeah. Yes, I remember that. That was funny.
And then we we'll review each, and then we pitch our version of a shared cinematic universe between those movies. So that's fun. And then, like you mentioned, the live thing, that's kind of been an experiment. We're going to cut it back now that summer's kind of ending. We're going to cut it back to like once a week. But for the most part, the last month or so, we did 3 days a week. Around lunchtime, we do a live show on CastBox. They have their new live cast feature, so we do an hour-long show on there. And that was primarily TV and movie news, mainly because I thought, for the most part, that'd be less niche. You know, I didn't know how many listeners are on that platform, so I figured that's a little bit more broad. Plus, you know, I like talking about those things. So, yeah, that's been kind of an interesting experience because it's way more interactive than I was expecting. A lot of times you'll do like a quote unquote live podcast, live stream a podcast, and it's pretty much just, you know, this, but people can listen.
Yes.
Whereas live cast, and you were on it, you said you haven't had the chance to listen a lot lately, but you were on it a couple times.
Yeah.
It's much more like a Facebook Live, but audio only, which is something I had been hoping Facebook would actually do forever, because you can chat, like there's the chat room with the listeners, and then people can call in super easy. So yeah, it's been interesting.
Cool. All right. Well, that's all we have today, Randy. It's been awesome. It's been fun. And I will definitely link your podcast, the Grolix podcast, in the show notes. So awesome. Go to covertnerd.net to find out how you can listen to Randy's show and Jesse and Melanie and everybody else. And it's been fun, Randy. We'll have to pick another topic like this and tackle it again, even in more detail.
Yeah. Thanks for letting me chat your ear off about Super Nintendo stuff. This is great. I don't think I've ever got to do a podcast about Super Nintendo stuff. So I'm glad you took me up on this.
Yes. Awesome. We'll have to find something else like that and be a first too. So,
all right.
Well, thanks, Randy. We'll have to do it again.
Yep. Thanks for having me, man.